Welcome to Manners and Madness, a Jane Austen and David Lynch podcast. My name is Maya Adkins.
And I'm Christian Cabrera. And today we'll be doing our second set of David Lynch shorts.
Yes! And these are actually old ones.
Yes.
I think they were all on the Eraserhead Criterion release.
Yes.
Yeah.
The collection.
Yeah. The Janus collection, perhaps?
Yeah, I would say. It seems like everyone was a Janus film.
Yes.
Janus film.
I really enjoyed these.
I did too. They were different.
Yeah. Well, what was your first impression?
So these, when I started with The Grandmother, which is the longest one.
Oh, okay.
And that one was super Eraserhead-y.
Yes.
That one was like the most to me like Eraserhead. So I was kind of like watching almost like, oh, this is like a spinoff.
Yeah. Yeah. There's definitely a lot of really very Eraserhead elements to it.
Oh yeah. But I don't know, like a lot of these minus maybe what was the one, I can't remember which one it was, a lot of them are very surrealist.
Uh-huh.
And surrealism is not my favorite. Just because it's a little, it always makes you feel a little unsettled.
Yeah.
But it's also one of those things where it's not like I hate it, I can always watch it, it's always entertaining.
Yeah, these are, well, I hesitate to even, you know, try to claim that I know what surrealism definitely is or isn't. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, I'm not a scholar. But either. I don't know. I don't know how much. I'm sure there are surrealist elements, especially in like The Grandmother and the alphabet. Some of them maybe not. Maybe you'd classify it in a different thing, but they definitely mm-hmm. all have like an uncomfortable feeling, like
yeah.
get under your skin, kind of like, it's not necessarily that scary or even that
right.
gross. I mean, yeah, there's a lot of gross elements, but like a lot of it's just painting and stuff, but still, like,
right,
you know, yeah, they definitely have like a squirmy quality.
Yeah. And I think from what I've read, at least, about surrealism is, and I might be wrong, but a lot of it is very like severe imagery, and like, it's all, I think it's mostly all in black and white, but it's just, it feels not as simplistic as just being a black and white picture or a black and white film. It's always very, like, striking, and I think it's purposely supposed to invoke you into a feeling of uncomfortableness.
Yeah.
Maybe not necessarily, like,
yeah,
grossness in all of them, but at least being
definitely.
Like, oh, that makes me feel kind of weird.
I remember watching some Salvador Dali film
uh-huh.
where it's, he stuck himself in the eye or something, and I was
no.
like, I can't take it.
Yeah, because we went to New York this year before the virus took over, and we went to the Met. Did we go to the Met? Maybe it was MoMA. I think it was MoMA. And they had like a whole surrealist section where they had like a bunch of Man Ray
uh-huh.
paintings and other artists that were, and Dali and stuff like that. And even those, like, they weren't, like, I think, the most uncomfortable-inducing paintings. But even those, I was like, these make you feel a certain way.
Mm.
And I don't know if I like it.
Yeah, I do like that kind of stuff. There's a really great
uh-huh.
Dali Museum in Sarasota.
Right, right, right.
Yeah, I've definitely been there. And I love a museum that's dedicated to one.
To one artist.
One artist. Those are my like, two of my favorite. That one and we went to the Vincent van Gogh Museum.
I was just about to say.
And that was like the best museum. I've been to so many museums, and that one was
the best.
That was
your favorite. Yeah, I haven't been to too many. I think I've only, like, you know, major museums, I've only been to the Met and MoMA, I think.
That's usually what I do if I ever go to a big city. I just go to all the museums.
All museums.
I don't do anything that interesting. Maybe see some shows and go to the museums. But anyway, back to, I guess I should give my first impressions.
Yeah.
Well, let's see. The first time I saw them was maybe a couple of years ago when I first got Filmstruck, and they had them all on there.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say, okay, well, like, they all had a different, obviously, impression. So,
mm-hmm.
but like, The Grandmother really felt, and The Alphabet kind of felt like black box plays to me.
Uh huh.
Just the way it was, so like the black background and like the furniture sitting in it. And so that evoked like a really weird feeling me, because I did a lot of black box plays when I was younger. And so I really did like those. I thought The six men getting sick was interesting. Mm-hmm. It was kind of, I think, maybe his making art move.
Yeah.
Thing.
Yeah. When I watched that one, I remembered how we had talked about his like thing was, I want to see paintings move. And I was like, this is where it started.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And you can see those elements incorporated into like the grandmother, at least.
Yeah.
The amputee, not my fave. Could definitely do without having to watch that one twice. But
yeah, I agree.
But my favorite, I think, well, I guess shouldn't say favorites yet, but I really liked Premonitions, Folly, and Evil Deed mm-hmm. when I just first watched it. And then, you know, hearing the story behind it, because there are some stuff. But we'll tell you all about that. But the story behind it was really interesting, too. Mm-hmm. Sorry, guys, if I am a little scatterbrained today. It's been a tough week, so. Anyway, yeah, I'll try to keep it on track as much as possible.
I said the chaoticness will match the chaoticness of...
It's true, it's true.
...shorts, because they went cuckoo.
Yeah, they were a little all over the place. But I'm excited to learn some more about them, so let's do the notes.
All righty. All right, so I'll be doing the notes today, and I broke them up by short. So we'll start with Six Men Getting Sick.
Okay.
It was his first film.
Oh, that perfect.
Yeah, so it was like,
making
gotta start with
your,
that.
Making your art move would be the perfect, yeah. Would be the, yeah, got it.
The sorry. Perfect start. Yeah. Yeah, that's when I found out this was his first film, and then I watched it, I was like, this is like, yeah, this is where it makes sense. Like, I think it's like the most bare bones, like, I want to see paintings move.
Yeah.
And it's a painting moving. It's also known as Six Figures Getting Sick.
Okay.
It debuted in 1967 at an experimental painting and sculpture contest at the end of the semester at Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts, where he went to school.
Cool.
It was well received and earned him a joint first prize.
I do love going to an art show and there's like the random video room.
Where you're like with a single couch. Or
and you're like, I wonder how long this goes on. Should I watch the whole thing or is it like hours and hours?
It was released for home media in 2001. The runtime is 4 minutes and the budget was only $200.
Wow.
Which Lynch referred to the sum as completely unreasonable, which I found funny. But yeah, I loved researching this one because I was like, this seems like the most college, and this is like, it's not a dig, but it's like the most college student art piece. Like, it just seemed like this is what I would expect from a very abstract artist.
I love it. Being a previous art student myself, I feel a kinship.
Yes. The next one is The Alphabet. I think this is right after this, Six Men. It was released in 1968. It was directed by David Lynch. Screenplay and cinematography were all by David Lynch. The cast is just Peggy Lynch, which is his former wife. Runtime is 4 minutes. Budget was $1,000.
Okay. More reasonable?
Yeah, say, that's a little more reasonable. And it was inspired by his niece's nightmares and the story about how his wife, on his wife's side, their niece, apparently he had found out that she was having nightmares and in her nightmares was reciting the alphabet, which sounds
creepy.
Creepy. I couldn't imagine being the parent walking in on that. But apparently that inspired him to make his own interpretation of what those nightmares were like.
Oh, interesting.
So very spooky, very scary. And as a result of the alphabet, he was awarded an American Film Institute production grant.
Yeah, that's what got him to Los Angeles, right?
I think so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's somebody, awesome.
He was rewarded for it. All right. So the next one is The Grandmother. It was released in...
Oh, yeah. That's what got him to be able to make The Grandmother.
Yeah.
That's
and
right.
Then
okay.
I think that basically got him to
do
Eraserhead because the parallels are...
Yeah.
Uncanny.
It's obvious where his mind was when he was starting his career.
Oh, yeah.
Or his aesthetic.
Oh, yeah. They're very similar. That's all I kept thinking about was the parallels between them. And I also, part of me was like, are we going to get any, like, connections? I was like, kind of looking for specifically a connection to that weird baby that was in Eraserhead. I really
do feel like there might have been some connections. But we'll get into that.
A lot of creepy crawlies. All right, the next one is The Grandmother, which was released in 1969. And it's the longest of the shorts of this group that we're doing. Its runtime is 34 minutes. It was directed by, screenplay by, cinematography by David Lynch. And the cast list was Richard White as the boy, Dorothy McGinnis as the grandmother, Virginia Maitland as the mother, and Robert Chadwick as the father.
Gotcha.
There weren't a ton of notes on the grandmother, which is, I thought was so interesting, since it was the longest, and it seemed to be the one that kind of kickstarted his career.
Yeah. But there weren't... seems like to be the easiest to really get into, you know?
Yeah, but there weren't a lot of stuff on it. Like, I found maybe one article, but it was very, not a very article full of facts. It was more like an opinion
kind of thing. Yeah.
So, but I thought it was...
But that one's the most straightforward, I would say. Easiest to just, like, understand by what you're seeing and what's going on.
Yeah, that one I feel like is more narrative.
Yeah.
Than kind of, like, just happenings, almost.
Yeah.
And the next one is The Amputee, which is broken up into two versions.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole story behind that is he had a friend who was given two different kinds of film to be used by the American Film Institute, and to see which ones they liked better. So they were going to film two of the same thing twice.
This was in the middle of them filming Eraserhead, right?
Yes. I think this one was... filmed while they were taking a break because they had run out of money.
Oh, okay, yeah.
So basically, he was given these two films, and they told him to direct the same thing twice to see which one they liked better, and they were going to buy a bunch of it. And so he went to Lynch and was like, "Hey, I've got these films." And Lynch was like, "Well, does it matter what you film?" And he said, "No." And basically, that turned into David Lynch saying, "If I write this, can we film it tomorrow?" And so he wrote The Amputee. And they filmed it twice. Both versions are about the same exact. You can kind of notice if you watch some of the little differences. I think in the second version, the noises, gargly noises. And
It's a little bit shorter. I think the letter is shorter.
Yeah. I think it's like a minute shorter.
Yeah.
Yeah, a minute shorter. Version 1's 5 minutes, 10 seconds. And version 2 is 4 minutes, 2 seconds.
Yes.
But version 2, to me, seemed the most animated. Because what would you call it? The amputated parts of the amputee were a lot more...
squirty.
yes. Squirty and just very animated and gross. All right. So it was initially released in 1974, directed in screenplay by David Lynch, and the cinematography was by Frederick Elms and Herbert Cardwell. And Frederick Elms was, I think, the friend who came to David about the film.
Yeah. But didn't he also... He was the cinematographer for Eraserhead, I think. At least half of it.
It sounds familiar.
And maybe Blue Velvet or something in Twin Peaks.
Yeah.
I feel like his name has popped up a few times.
Because I saw his name and I was like, I know this name. the total runtime together is 9 minutes, but, you know, as we said, version 1's 5. Version 2 is 4. The cast is Catherine Coulson as the amputee.
Yes.
And we were talking earlier about the nurse and how we couldn't decide. We were like, it seemed to have like a female typical
clothing
and hair. But when the frame just seemed a little more masculine, and the female nurse was David Lynch. So.
Wow.
Yeah. That's the only two people.
Very young. Oh, okay.
Catherine Coulson and David.
For some reason, I thought you were going to say it was Frederick Elms.
Nope. It was Lynch. And then there was some...
Don't make me watch it again.
Please. The last one is Premonitions Following an Evil Deed. And it's the most recent of these group. It was released in 1995.
Mm-hmm.
The runtime is a little over a minute. And it was directed by David Lynch. The story behind this one was really interesting. I guess... Was it AFI, American Film Institute, was giving out this Lumiere?
I'm not sure if it was the Film Institute, but it could have been.
But
it was definitely a Lumiere camera.
They were, like, giving them out to filmmakers around the world and being, like...
Which was, like, maybe the first film camera ever made.
Yeah.
Type of a thing.
And if you watch it, you can definitely tell. It's real old.
Yeah.
But this, apparently, he was given this to film, and... They had 3 takes and that's it. You weren't allowed to take any more than that. I think you were allowed to edit the film afterwards to kind of cut it together. But you had 3 takes, all black and white, and...
It was like 55 seconds worth of film.
Yeah, basically that's like all
one,
you could do.
One reel was 55 seconds.
Right, yeah. Yeah, there's a really... If you have the Criterion Channel app, there's a really good... It's like a 1.5 minute little like comment that...
Yeah.
David Lynch does on it, and it's really a really interesting story.
Yeah.
And he kind of goes into like the particulars of
what I would
the
love to watch like a whole documentary on this camera and their experiment that they did. I wonder if there is one. There might be. I'll have to check that up. I'm
sure. And so the cast list for this one was Jeff Alperi as the cop, Michelle Carlisle as the woman, Stan Lothridge as the other cop, Russ Perlman as the dead son, Pam Pirosic as the mother, Kathleen Raymond as the woman, Joan Rertelstein as the other woman, Don Salcido as the woman in tank, Clyde Small as the father, and Mark Wood as the other cop.
Wow. I wasn't expecting such a large cast list. Yeah. Who were all the masked security guards in that one?
I guess they were just uncredited extras or something. But yeah, this one was interesting. And like I said, he only had three takes he could do. And we watched it again right before we started this. And I noticed there were four scenes total. So I think what he ended up doing was each one of the scenes had to be, I guess, set up side by side so he could just pivot the camera really fast.
Yeah.
But basically, he just took one take per scene and was like, this is it. Which I thought was, like, to me at least, would be really scary because I would be like, I want it to be perfect.
Yeah, but I guess, well, it seems like David Lynch is good with embracing, like, imperfections and making them into something interesting on their own.
Yeah, I think it also helps that there's no sound.
Yeah.
It's silent.
Yeah.
Except there's music, but there's no dialogue. But yeah, I just had so much fun looking these up because like these little like student art films and like shorts I'm always so interested by because you know, when you think of like filmmakers and stuff, you think of like the big movies, even if they're indie films, right. They're long films, but these like little like quick little 5-minute shorts, like
definitely it's like a real insight into the creative process, which is kind of my favorite part of art in general. It's just the creative process, so that's why I've always, like, been drawn to smaller artists and, you know, just because I just love watching the beginning stages of...
Oh, yeah. It was really interesting. This group was really good in the way that you could kind of see his evolution, almost, because from the beginning, you could definitely see the references to his immediate thought process of why he wanted to become a filmmaker.
Yeah.
And the bare bones of it, and then kind of building it up until we get to Premonitions, which is... To me, it's the most recent, but it also uses the oldest style of film. But it feels more modern than the rest of them.
Yeah, it does. Well, it definitely feels like, you've learned a lot of things along the way.
Yeah, there's like a little bit more narrative, and it just, I think it flows the best.
Yeah.
Out of all of them.
Yeah. Well, let's get into the recap. I actually started with Premonitions from An Evil Deed because I kind of went in order of shortest to longest. Like you said, 1995. All of these have like a Janus Films title card at the front. So I don't know if that's something to do with when they actually release them or whatever. But okay, so we start off. We see three police officers walking towards a body lying in the dirt. And then we see a woman in a house. Mm-hmm. She looks over and then you get like a black still frame. And I think there's like the sounds of horses walking. There's like a clip-clop kind of a
you know how horses do.
My favorite sound. And there's also kind of like a sci-fi silent movie atmospheric kind of ominous music going on. Okay, so we come from the black frame and we see, it kind of looks like an old romantic era painting. And it's like two women sitting on a sofa in their like drapery robes.
Yeah, it almost reminds me, it's like a weird like duality because like their hair and makeup reminded me a lot of like old school like royalty, like French royalty almost. Because it was very like up and like kind of like a like a tower, and like their makeup was really like you could tell they were done up.
Yeah,
but their dresses to me almost feel like have you ever watched The Beguiled?
No.
It's like I think Civil War era like South.
Oh, okay.
And it's like that long flowy white, just kind of like crinoline and all that stuff. Their dresses kind of look like that.
Yeah. They reminded me of, like, I think it's something to do with, like, the sofa, the fancy sofa being under a tree and them kind of, like, lounging with their hair all in tousled curls and stuff. Kind of just felt, like, straight out of a Jane Austen era painting. Like, yeah. Or maybe a little bit pre-Jane Austen, but, like, the romantic era.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I liked it a lot.
Anyway, that was just one tiny little scene.
that was the shortest scene.
They get up as if they're going to investigate something, and then we get a white still frame, and then we see a bunch of men either wearing masks or, like, maybe with bandages wrapped around their heads or something. They kind of have weird mutant heads.
Yeah,
and they seem to be guards of some sort. One of them is hitting a tank with, like, a club, but and there's a naked woman submerged in the tank. It's kind of like a stick, but we also are hearing these electricity noises, so it kind of feels like maybe he's electrifying it. There was something I was going to say about that scene. Oh, I feel like it reminds me of... I feel like that scene could have been lifted straight from a dystopian video game adventure. Yeah. Like, I feel like I've played a video game with that scene in it.
Yeah. Have you ever played Bioshock?
No, I've never played that one.
It's like an old... No, I say old. It's from, like, I think... the late 2000s is when it started, or like early 2010s, and it's like this almost like dystopian underwater world, and like you're this person that is like in like almost like a inspired by the old Deep Divers, and then you know there's this like kind of ghosty girl that's like your sidekick, but a lot of it is like sciencey mad scientist creatures and like empty tanks like this. It kind of reminded me of that because everyone I think is masked in that game except for the girl.
Oh, yeah.
Which is really creepy.
Well, this scene ends by they kind of like wipe the camera through the frame, and at the end there's like almost like a piece of flash paper that erupts and burns kind of into another scene, which is just interesting little scene change.
I liked it.
And then we see the woman from the beginning who's sitting in the living room with a man, and it just looks like a normal living room, like a modern living room. She's like wearing an apron, and she gets up and walks over to the door and looks out as a police officer walks up, probably one of the ones from the first scene. And he's obviously telling them bad news, and I'm guessing it's something to do with the body that they found, and then it's blackout. But, like, it tells the whole story, and the premonition part is crazy. Yeah. I don't really understand that part, but I like it.
Yeah, I think we were talking about, like, you know, different points in the movie where we're like, is this where the premonition is? Like, what is the premonition of?
Yeah. Is it the woman who's having the premonition?
Yeah, in the tank.
Yeah.
Or, and then I think we also talked about the lounging ladies.
Yeah.
That woman who kind of like shoots up and kind of walks forward, is she having the premonition? And I was just thinking, is the premonition of the boy or is it of the woman in the tank? Because the woman in the tank kind of seems a little more futuristic.
Yeah, it would be really weird if the lady who seemed like she was from the past was having a premonition of something from what seems like even the future to us.
Yeah. Ugh.
Anyway, that was a really interesting one. It was like 1 minute long. We talked about it for a while.
So interesting.
And then we're going back in time to the earliest days. You said it was his first movie. Six Men Getting Sick is the next one I did. We get kind of like this is mostly art.
Right.
Or it is all art. We get like a countdown, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1 countdown, which I just noticed that he still kind of does similar things in his more artistic film shorts. Like Fire and stuff had like the 3, 2, 1, but it was all drawn. Anyway, just a little parallel. It looks like, it definitely is a piece of his early art. It's like 5 heads in various stages of distress. And I think I heard that those were all his head. Like, he based it off of his own head.
I can kind of see that.
One of them looks like he has whiskers. And then a siren starts. And what I guess is them getting sick at the beginning are like geometric lines that come out of their mouths and make squares and rectangles, and they form kind of a head in between two of them, so I guess that's the sixth man. And then he like also forms an x-ray body, like and then black moves up the square art piece like water to reveal some sort of blob with a swirl, blobs with swirls, and tubes and pipes leading up to the heads. later on, I figured they're probably stomachs, but at this point, I was like, there's some sort of blobby thing.
Some sort of mass.
And then, kind of like in Fire, the one we watched, hands come up and cover the mouths of the heads.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a flash of a red flame. And then we're back to the faces, and color starts to appear in the swirls in the stomachs.
Mm-hmm.
And that ends in the x-ray and out of the mouths. And then there's the word sick in the bottom corner. And then the stomachs, I call them blobs the whole time. The stomachs fill up with red and the hands move down to cover them. And then the hands move back to the faces and the blobs go kind of brown and start spilling. No, I mean the stomachs. I keep pulling the blobs. Then a match lights a string at the bottom of the frame.
Mm-hmm.
And then we switch to the heads against a purple background. And there's like white, sick, spilled sickness coming down from the heads.
Yeah.
And then we go back to the original sequence, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. And the same sequence starts happening again. So that's the second time, except maybe a little bit quicker this time. And then the whole thing repeats again and then starts over again. And then 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, blobby things, weird x-ray hands, purple again, 6 times. And then there's still one more. So I know it's called Six Men Getting Sick 6 times, but I counted 7. So
let's say, is one of these times maybe them not getting sick?
Maybe the first one doesn't count. And it's like the subsequent times are the Six Men Getting Sick 6 times. Or maybe I just counted wrong. and the siren is wailing the whole time.
Mm-hmm.
So I can definitely imagine going into an art gallery, a student art show, and being like, go into this little room, watching this thing, and be like, okay. I get it. I'd probably leave after the second time.
Yeah. Well, it's like one of these things where like you never have a runtime listed with these exhibits. So it's like, I don't want this to be one of those 8-hour films.
Yeah.
But yeah, whenever I watched this one and then I found out that he entered it in like a contest and got joint first prize with another artist, I always think about like these things, like how do you judge these as artists, especially these that seem to be so interpretive and like are not saying like, this is what it is, or these are the things that we want to make you feel. And then I also think about like, as like a judge or like a professor or whatever, you would probably look for notes of this style and be like, how are all these notes being used?
It's really hard to say because I think that there's probably really good and bad critics and judges of art out there. Yeah. So, but I think tend to be, at least in my experience, an art judge would normally go for what is the most unique, interesting, you know, not done before type of
thing. And like what invokes the most response.
Yeah, that too.
Yeah. Okay, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Because I always, like, I would picture myself, like, going through an art and sculpture show and then coming upon this video and being like, huh, this is really interesting.
Well, it is interesting. I liked it. You know, it's not one that I would necessarily want to watch a million times because I don't really need to watch Six Men Getting Sick, but I like the the way it like builds up and like, and then it gets faster and faster and faster. All right, let's move on to the amputee.
As you roll your eyes.
Well, I mean, it's just
a gross. It's a gross.
Gross. One. It's gross.
Yeah, I think that's what it's supposed to do.
Yeah, I mean, he's just doing it for like, he came up with it in a day, and
yeah,
it's interesting. I like being able to see Catherine Coulson.
Yeah. She, what I loved about this one was, like, she doesn't have any dialogue. Well, she does have dialogue, but it's, like, not like she's actively speaking it. It's, like, her writing.
Yeah.
But I feel like I found her so engaging.
Yeah. I definitely tried to focus on her and her story myself because, you know, I was, like, I can't look at this, whatever's going on with this thing.
And the nurse.
Yeah. Okay, so I think the description said, a double amputee attempts to write a letter while her nurse gets in the way. Starring Catherine Coulson. So she's sitting in a chair. She's got amputated legs. She's writing a letter and smoking. And we hear her narrate what she's writing. It's not like she's talking out loud.
Right.
She is defending that Jim really said that. She was in the room when he said it. He told her everything was fine between Helen and him. And we hear in the background, someone comes into the room and we can see them in the corner washing their hands. And David Lynch, we now know. And then the nurse comes over and sticks Catherine with a hypodermic needle in the leg. Blech. And she doesn't react, just keeps writing her letter. She doesn't even react at all to what's Mm-mm. going on. And then she's writing about Helen and says that she was her best friend, so maybe they will now believe her. This whole letter is her being very defensive and being like, you should trust me when I say what I say, and you don't know what you're talking about. Meanwhile, the nurse is beginning to unwrap her bandages as she talks about getting sick of the beach, and the nurse starts clipping at something under the bandage. There's a lot of clipping.
I hate that noise.
She doesn't react. She's recounting a story about how this guy, one of the guys she's been talking about, obviously the bad one, who I think she left or whatever, he had turned all the burners on the stove when they left their vacation house because he wanted to burn down the whole row of houses. And she said it made her sick, and that was it for her. And then the nurse starts squirting water into the leg and using cotton pads to blot it. And then she's saying that she wasn't a flirt then, and she's not a flirt now. And I was like, the stump on her leg looks really gross. Thankfully, this is not a test for HD films, Doc.
No. Thank the Lord.
And then the stump starts squirting. The nurse is dabbing at it with cotton. It's a very incompetent nurse. I'm like, you don't know what you're doing.
Yeah.
And Catherine is talking about how this guy never knew Jim, and he got it all wrong. Him and Joanne. And then the nurse stands up and really starts to dig into the leg. It starts with more liquid, and the nurse seems disturbed and runs out of the room. And Catherine is still just sitting there serenely writing her letter and smoking. And we're hearing, like, splashy water sounds.
God.
And she says, "Where were you when Paul got home at 3 a.m? And that's the end of the scene.
Gross. Yeah. I was watching the whole time, and like you said, she had no reaction to it. But what I also kept thinking about the whole time was, who botched her amputations? Because these are not healing properly. These are not sealed properly. Something is wrong.
Yeah. Luckily, the film stock they were testing was not the best quality, so you could not really see a lot of detail.
Tell what it was.
The second version is just seems like a more grainy film.
Yeah.
But it seems pretty much exactly the same. I think the nurse might do a few different things, but it's a little bit shorter. There's more squirting, I think, in this one.
Yeah, there's more like animation with the leg.
But I don't think the film stock is better. I think the first film stock was better.
Me too. I remember when they both... after watching the first version and the second version started, I was like, they look exactly the same to me. But then after watching it more, I was like, oh, you can tell it's a little bit grainier.
Yeah.
It's not as good quality.
But let's move on from the amputee because it's too gross to linger on.
Yeah.
Okay. So then we have the alphabet. Okay. And this was based on the dream. So we hear A, B, C being chanted by children as a boy sleeps, or is it the girl? Oh, I guess there's only one person in it.
It's the girl.
Yeah. So then the alphabet, handwritten, is it just drawn onto the, it's like written onto the screen or something? Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's a person with red lips and a white face and black goggle looking glasses.
Mm-hmm.
And then we hear someone singing scales, possibly in another language.
Yeah. I didn't understand it.
Yeah. Visually, okay, so what we're seeing is kind of looks like a music staff, but laying on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, the five lines. In the top corner, there's a yellow circle and a rectangle, and little boxes with letters appear on the staff. Music notes, presumably, maybe?
Yeah.
Then the yellow circle becomes surrounded by colorful dots. Oh, I guess it's up here. And more weird notes appear. A line of G's and an H. That one is not a music note because the scale only goes up to G. Then the sky starts to fill up with those colorful dots. and they almost kind of look like starlings, you know, like the birds. And the alphabet is showing up progressively on the staff. So then we see the red mouth again, but it's a close-up on the mouth, and it's in, like, a barred circle. It looks very Rocky Horror. And we hear kind of, like, this whiny bug sound. And then it switches to what looks like a game of Pong.
Yeah,
there's like a dot going up a thing. It's very computer looking. And then there's a flashy A, which is maybe a tree. And there's windy sounds. And to the right is a small yellow flower. And then the A blows a cloud, which poops out more A's. And then the sound of a baby, which I was like, that is the Eraserhead baby.
Yeah.
That's the same baby sounds. And then there's kind of a, I don't know what I was writing. I wrote, and there's a kind of A-headed thingy in a box slash room. The A turns into a head slash box, and we can kind of hear comforting mommy sounds while the baby cries. I feel like I should have watched this again because I'm like, do I remember what I'm talking about?
It's confusing.
So a head, the head thingy, maybe turns into a brain, and then kind of a Picasso slash Dolly looking face. And then we get a close up and see that it's like a collage of some sort with, like, you know, I think it's a collage. Then geometric stuff turns into a heart, which seems to bleed into the head. And the head is shocked. And there's a flash to a real woman, the woman from the beginning, who is shocked. And the collage face starts to cry blood and melts. And then we see an upside down version of the red mouth with, like, a nose on the chin.
Yes.
And it says, please remember, you're dealing with the human form. And then we hear the kids chanting A, B, C again. And lots of dots changing color. And then the red-lipped woman, I guess it's the same woman. Well, of course it is. We know that. But she's asleep in the bed. And the dots appear all over the sheets. And a green snake-looking thing comes out of her mouth. And her eyes flutter open.
Blech.
And then she sings the ABC song. And a series of weird stills with her and letters.
Yeah, it's like she's all over the room.
Yeah, and she, like, they're held up by string and lit by, like, a flash or spotlight or something. It's very creepy, but very, like, I feel like a photographer made this part.
Yeah.
And her face seems wrapped in string or wire or something, and her expression changes a lot. And at the end, it looks like, you know, the Jacob's Ladder thing that you could do with string as a kid. You would do like the thing. It kind of looks like that around her head.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so that whole part at the end gave me a real Exorcist vibe.
Me too, me too.
The last thing that happens is in bed, she starts spitting up blood as wind noises, which are definitely made by a mouth, like...
Yeah. Well, those wind noises that I... When I heard them, I was like, Eraserhead.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
So lots of references to Eraserhead in here.
Yeah. Yeah, that one definitely was like, oh, you're going to take a lot of these ideas. And that baby, that was definitely the same baby. I mean, the sounds.
So she's in the same universe. Is it, maybe it's, is that Catherine Coulson's character?
Oh, Catherine, not Catherine Coulson.
Not Catherine Coulson.
Bobby Briggs' mom. Charlotte Stewart.
Yes. That's who I meant. Is that her as a younger child having a nightmare of the baby? Maybe it's her premonition.
Yes, in my head canon, I will try to imagine that from now on.
Yes, they're connected.
All right, finally, we get the grandmother. Okay. Okay, this one was a little bit longer. So we start with art again. We see a tube coming out of the water, and it's like spitting, and it makes... like a man slash diver slash rocket.
Yeah.
That blasts up and emerges on like actual film out of the leaves in the ground, like emerging out of the ground and the leaves.
Yeah.
And then the tube makes another woman version and they both emerge from the leaves and start kissing. And then a white and red drop come out of each of the tube and combine in another tube. And there's like a stuttering close up on the man who has a very strange mask like face. I was like, I guess David was really into cheek prosthetics at the time. Because yeah. I was thinking of the, yeah, because it has like kind of a Commedia dell'arte mask looking face.
Yeah, it's a little bit of a really dramatic, like curled smile.
Yes.
Kind of feel.
Yeah. So the red and white drop combo tube makes a little kid. And I wrote, Lynch has some weird ideas about how babies are made.
He said, this is the way, and this is the only way.
Because I remember at the beginning of Eraserhead, it was like, oh, the baby is like the sperm coming out of the mouth, and then it crashes into the thing.
Yeah. Onto this, like, puddle.
Yeah. So the kid emerges into the real world, and the man starts barking at the kid while the woman kind of tries to hold him back. This is all feeling very primal at the very beginning.
Oh, yeah.
They both have, like, slowed down, kind of like ape or monkey qualities to mm-hmm. the sounds that they're making. The man attacks the kid as the woman cries, and this is also mirrored in the Art Tube Land, where the kid like flies away.
Right.
And so then we're into the real world. I say that with quotation marks.
Whatever that is.
We see a very white faced kid, very white. Everyone in this is like
clown face.
He's in a bow tie and he's looking at his barren room, which has a chalk door, mm-hmm. which is cool. Also very black box.
Yes.
He looks at some dried flowers. The parents are still like crawling around in the dirt in the scene. And then they blast off in the painting. And they're inside this black home. Box play set. And he's drinking and she's curling her hair. And they're both also very white faced. Then we're more art. We get a blue box with sun. And then we see the boy in bed in the real world. Well, I mean, on film. And he looks under the covers and he seems surprised. And we hear the sounds of water sloshing in the background. And he dresses in his suit again and covers up the yellow spot on his bed. Because this is what the whole film is about, is a boy who wets his bed. The dad comes in, he uncovers the sheet and screams, "Mad, mad, mad!" And then he drags the kid in and throws him on the bed and puts his nose in it like a dog. He's very violent to this child.
Yeah, very abusive.
Very abusive. The kid is kind of screaming. Mm-hmm. So then we see the woman and she's like gesturing for the kid to come over and starts to like pet him. But then it turns into like her shaking him when he resists her giving him a drunken kiss. Mm-hmm. And then she starts to violently rub her own face, still like manhandling the kid. And there's kind of like a stop motion as the kid walks away and the woman lays on the floor. Mm-hmm. So it's like a click, click, click. Okay, so then the kid is back in his room. He hears something like a whistle upstairs. And it's very, very dark, black and white. He looks amazed as he climbs the stairs. And I wonder if that's why their faces are all painted white, because it's like such a low light. Or like such a dark quality to the black and white.
Especially with like every room being painted almost all black.
Yeah. And... yeah. Okay. So yeah. So then there's like another chalk room. Mm-hmm. Has a bed and a big bag labeled seeds. So he takes them out and he like shakes them all until he finds the whistling seed.
Yes.
And he puts the seed on the pillow and grabs a red bucket of dirt and he empties several buckets worth of dirt onto the bed and plants the seed, which looks like a rock.
I thought it was a potato. It looked like a potato to me.
It was a potato because it does kind of look like a spiky potato later on. So he buries the potato rock in the pile and then he waters it and we hear the sounds of a thunderstorm and then crickets. And when the boy comes back in later, it's turned into this giant spiky potato.
Ugh, scary looking.
And he waters it again and it grows and we can actually see the roots coming out from under the bed. And he's like smilingly watching it and he's sitting with it and it's now quite large and spiky. And he pets the moss at the bottom of the base and I was like, is that pubic hair? Things took a turn.
I do not like it.
But I don't know that it is because it's actually where she emerges from. So
maybe it's her head hair.
Okay. There's definitely something a little disturbing about that part. More watering. The kid is just loving this giant potato. So then we see the blue box with the yellow sun again. Then we see more mad dad and crazy mom. They're so violent.
Mm-hmm.
Upstairs, the boy is smiling and amazed because from the base of this monstrosity he's grown, a person emerges and he helps her out as if he's a midwife. And it makes these weird, wet, squelchy noises.
Again.
So the woman is laying on the ground and she sits up and the kid gets the dried flowers from his room and brings them upstairs to her. And she looks at him after much suspense and smiles. And they sit together and they look so cute and happy. And the pod potato thing disintegrates. So then we're back. The whole family is at, minus grandma, is at the table eating dinner. It's very dirty. And we hear like lawnmower chanting noises while they all eat.
Very weird noises.
Yeah, very gross eating by mom and dad.
Of course.
And they kind of shake and they yell at the kids some more. I think they say, I don't know if they're saying mad or mutt. It's like mutt, yeah, mutt, or mod.
I kept hearing mod.
Mod, maybe.
But maybe I was like, mad makes more sense.
Yeah, I don't know. But I wrote, I hate these parents.
Me too. They're so mean.
They're horrible. The kid runs up to grandma, who's sleeping, and gives her a kiss. And he eats from a bowl of fruit up in the attic.
He's really stuffing his face.
Yeah, I guess he didn't eat anything with those at dinner. So grandmother is rocking and whistling, and that wakes the boy. And his sheets are like, they just keep getting progressively more yellow as it goes on. He sneaks upstairs, but he gets ambushed.
Ugh.
And we see that in the art, it looks like two people getting their heads cut off with the pull of a string.
Yeah, well, it's like, it was his, the boy's, like, little cartoon, and he gets, like, a pointy hat on.
Uh-huh, like a wizard?
Yeah, like a wizard, almost, like, I almost thought, like, a dunce cap.
Oh, uh-huh.
But then it wouldn't make sense that he's in charge, because he's pulling the string with all these things that happen.
Yeah.
Interesting.
So, yeah, so then his bed actually kind of erupts in, like, a river of yellow.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
Shoots out.
In the art world, he falls into a pool of yellow, and his parents blow up and break apart. We go back to the grandmother in her chair, and the boy throws himself on her dirty bed. And then we hear some nice singing, like, oohs. I think is she singing?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. She's smiling and kind of shakes her head, and the boy seems very weary, but she's very encouraging. And they both smile, and she talks to him, and he talks to her, and they poke each other in the shoulders.
Yeah, they just start poking
and cheeks for a while, and then they kiss somewhat inappropriately.
Yeah, I didn't like it.
I mean, it's just like they just kind of touch lips, but like the way it happens is not a grandmother.
No,
son, it's a little type of kiss. Then we see the art again. Someone floats down and starts pulling stuff out of the ground. Maybe the grandma?
Maybe.
She gets this long, blue, glowy snail head. Oh, snail head. And then the kid floats down. And I wrote again, these parts remind me of fire.
Mm-hmm.
He grows into a tree with a big, glowy trumpet at the top.
Mm-hmm.
And then a pipe comes out. I think it comes... No, it comes out below the trumpet. And waters the ground. And then Blue flies into the trumpet and comes out as a bug. And the music is kind of sweet in this scene.
Mm-hmm.
So the bug sucks at something, and we see the grandmother shake in bed with, like, there's fluttery wing sounds.
Mm-hmm.
And the boy's asleep, and the grandmother is whistling for him, but grabs her throat. And he wakes up, runs up the stairs. His sheets are just basically yellow now. She starts whistling like a teapot, which I feel like we definitely heard that teapot whistling noise in Eraserhead.
Oh, yeah. And there's like choking noises in the background.
Yeah. It's surprising that it took so long for them to do the sounds for Eraserhead when he already had this clear store that he's been using. So the kid runs in, tries to help, but he keeps grabbing his ears. Mm-hmm. He runs downstairs to tell Dad, who doesn't seem to care, and he shakes the boy some more. The mom is laughing, and Grandma is running around crazy, grasping her throat. The kid is very upset as he arrives back upstairs, and the whistling stops. So then we see the kid in an overgrown graveyard, mm-hmm. walking slowly up a path. He finds his grandmother in her rocker next to some graves, and he looks at her sadly, and she peers at him and freezes, and then he screams. Ugh. And then back at home, he lays in his bed staring at the ceiling. He rolls over violently, and an art potato is maybe chalked onto the wall over him. Looks like part of him. Does that make sense when I say kind it like of. That?
Yeah.
Okay, so some lines come in towards the potato, and it goes to black.
Huh.
And that's it.
It was an interesting one. The story didn't go like how I thought it was. Like, I thought kind of like it was going to be the story about these, like, abusive parents and, like, almost like a story about how, like, grandparents are, like, your comfort.
Yeah.
And so he grows a grandma to save himself.
Yeah.
But clearly nothing. He did not save himself.
It's almost like he also kind of, I don't know, because it's hard to say, like, what really happened? Because, like, he, in the art world, he, like, cut the head off of his parents.
Yeah.
But they still were around, and then they laughed in his face, and then he lost his grandma.
Yeah, I was trying to think, because usually, like, bedwetting is, like, a sign of, like, trauma.
Yeah.
And, like, stress. And I wonder if maybe when we get to the point where it's, like, erupting out of the bed, like, it's almost, like, maybe a quote-unquote breaking point.
Yeah. Or maybe it's just about, like, when your grandmother is your only
refuge
from your abusive parents, which seems like she might have had some of her own issues going on too with the weird inappropriate moments.
Yeah.
But like then he's got nowhere to turn.
What I did like about this was the most of it was in black and white, but then you have with like the yellow in the bed and the fruit in the bowl, the really like stark colors.
Yeah,
because the yellow in the bed was almost like an egg yolk yellow.
Yeah. And the alphabet also had that with like the red lips, where it all seems black and white except for, oh wait,
here's a little splash of color.
Yeah,
which I really enjoy that.
Yeah. I wonder if it's just because he painted everything black and white that it looks black and white.
Maybe.
And then he just painted the color. That's interesting. Yeah, so that was the recap.
Very interesting set
of
shorts.
Should we talk about which our favorite one was?
Yeah.
Or our favorite part.
Favorite parts. My favorite part was from Premonitions. I really enjoyed that, like, romanticism scene with those two ladies on the couch.
Uh-huh.
And, like, kind of outside. I just thought it was so, I don't know, it felt very old Hollywood to me.
Yeah.
And because of the Lumiere film, just kind of, like, almost feel like that golden age of Hollywood. And it just was so pretty and almost, like, calming, like, in contrast to the rest of that short.
I liked that scene, too, especially contrasted with the next crazy scene, which... Now thinking back, I know we're saying kind of it seemed future dystopian type, but it also kind of seemed like the old timey sci-fi.
Yeah.
Except for like the naked person, but like,
you know. I know what you mean. Yeah.
Yeah. I think that one was probably my favorite too, I think it was just so well done to have such a like story and such a small, limited amount of, you know, a lot of restrictions.
Yeah. I think it just displayed his culmination over time of all his skills.
Yeah.
And he just put all, like, everything into it.
Yeah. But I also really liked the alphabet. I liked, you know, seeing a lot of the ideas that show up later.
Yeah.
In his, like, and he said that was the one that, like, gave him the bug that made him really want to do filmmaking.
Right.
So, yeah, that was a really interesting one, too.
Yeah. Yeah. I think my favorite short out of ones we saw was Premonitions.
Yeah.
I think the one I didn't like the most was, I think it was Six Men Getting Sick.
Mm. I liked that one, not like as something I would want to watch over and over, but I liked that one. But I did not like the amputee. did not care for that one.
Gross noises. Gross, gargly, gross.
Yeah, it was not because it was like horrible or anything, just because it grossed me out.
Yeah, and it's not like any of these are bad. It's just
Yeah.
Just wasn't, that specific one didn't speak to me.
Okay, so let's do the deep dive. Mm-hmm. Talked a lot. It's amazing how such short pieces can inspire so many words to describe them because they're so indescribable. Okay, so but this week I decided to do the deep dive on our third Catherine of the podcast. I can't believe how many Catherines we've done deep dives on in the past month or so.
It's a string of Catherines.
But we're doing on Catherine Elizabeth Coulson.
Yes.
The star of the one that was my least favorite, but she is one of my favorites.
Yes.
Let's see. So she was born October 22nd, 1943 in Elmhurst, Illinois, but she grew up in Southern California. Her mother was a ballet dancer. And her father was a radio and television producer and public relations executive. She got a BA at Scripps College and an MFA at San Francisco State University. She met David Lynch in 1971 and, as we learned in Eraserhead, performed various behind-the-scenes functions during the 4 years of filming.
Good Lord.
She actually supposedly began meditating at the same time as David Lynch, which was during this period.
Mm-hmm.
And also, this was the time period she did The Amputee.
Right.
During the Eraserhead filming, David Lynch told her that he had this image of her in his head, of her holding a large log. And 15 years later, he went on to create the role of the log lady for her.
Yes.
In 2010, she was in the Twin Peaks episode of Psych, Dual Spires.
Ooh.
And she was also in the second episode of Portlandia. Ah. But she was, I think, mostly a theater actor, and mm-hmm. she worked with the Oregon Shakespeare Festival a lot.
Oh.
She was in the play Calvin Marshall, which was directed by Gary Lundgren, and she went on to play Susie in Lundgren's film Redwood Highway.
Okay.
So she married Jack Nance, Pete Martel, in 1968. They divorced in 1976. Her second husband, Mark Sorensky, is a rabbi, and she converted to Judaism in the 1980s.
Hmm.
The two had a daughter in 1987 named Zoe.
Oh.
On September 28th, 2015, she died of complications from cancer at her home in Ashland. The first episode of Twin Peaks Season 3 was dedicated to her, and the 15th episode was dedicated to her character, Margaret Lanterman.
Aww.
She got two dedications. Yeah. So many dedications in Season 3 of Twin Peaks. Very cryworthy. Okay, so some of the things that I didn't mention that she also did film-wise, she was in 1982, she was in Trick or Treats, 1991, Femme Fatale. And also, she was in a movie, Another You, in 1991. And in 1995, she was in the movie The Four Diamonds. Okay. Now, as I was doing some research on her, I discovered that there is a documentary about her that was funded on Kickstarter, and it's nearly done.
Oh, wow.
Should be done soon, according to the last update I saw. It's called I Know Catherine, the Log Lady.
Huh.
And I was thinking maybe one day we could actually cover that on the podcast, because now that I'm reading over it, I'm like, this is such a boring biography of Jennifer.
That'd be really interesting. I'd love to see maybe some interviews she did or something.
Yeah, I'd like to really get to know her too.
Mm-hmm.
So I did. She is a Libra.
Huh.
But she's right on the cusp of Scorpio, like a day away. But Libras are represented by the scales. And they're ruled by Venus.
Mm-hmm.
They are a cardinal air sign. People born under Libra are peaceful, fair, and they hate being alone. Partnership is very important to them. They are fascinated by balance and symmetry and are in constant chase for justice and equality. They are peacekeepers who try to avoid conflict. Now, for her character from The Amputee.
Yes.
I don't know specifically, but I do know that Aquarius is associated with lower legs, ankles, and circulation.
Oh, wow.
So I was thinking maybe an Aquarius.
Aren't Aquarii? aren't they a little more into the emotional side, too?
No, I think they're actually kind of detached, so that would actually be appropriate for her.
Yeah.
Because they're air signs.
Yeah.
They're, like, always thinking of new and interesting theories and stuff, and they can become a little detached from, you know, really? Personal stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as what, so yeah, did you have any other thoughts on that? Like the astrology?
No.
No. Okay. Well, I thought, I was trying to think, what would I have liked to see her play in the Jane Austen canon?
Yes.
And my first thought was I would have loved to have seen her play Anne Elliot, because mm-hmm. I think she could have given some real, because Anne Elliot is like, we've only seen the one adaptation so uh-huh. far, but I find her when I read the books to be much more like sure of herself,
uh-huh.
even though nobody really listens to her or whatever, but it's like she doesn't really care that much.
Uh-huh.
And so I would have really, I think she would have played a really good Anne Elliot. Or maybe something funny like Miss Bates, or even like a Lady Catherine de Bourgh might be really funny.
Yeah, or really like maybe strange Catherine de Bourgh, like yeah. this strange old lady who's super rich mm-hmm. and has led this crazy life.
Yeah.
I like that. I could see her, oh my God, I'm blanking on the movie title. What's that movie title with the girl? She gets sent, she gets sent to live with...
Mansfield Park?
Yes. I literally was like going through my Rolodex. I was like, we've watched all these movies. I should know this.
Oh, don't worry. The more we watch, the more you'll know.
I'm really bad at forgetting these things. But it's I love to see her as a Fanny Price.
Oh, I did think about that. Like a really young, when she was really young, mm-hmm. I think she would make a great Fanny Price.
Yeah. Yeah. Just kind of like quiet and almost like disillusioned with this family. And
yeah. But you can really see like, she's got a
fighter back quality. Of
steel.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Standing up for what's right.
Yeah.
I could see her that.
I agree. All right. Final thoughts?
Yes. I enjoyed these shorts. It was kind of a departure from his last set of shorts because... I felt like most of the last ones were kind of funny.
Oh, more, yeah, yeah,
like, comedic. Maybe minus fire. But...
Yeah.
These all tend to be a little bit more, like, either suspenseful or scary.
Yeah. I think that's something that happens as you get older. You're like, you want to start off yeah. really serious, but as you get older, you're like,
The know. Funny is... Yeah. Well, I think there's
life
also...
Life is absurd.
Yeah. Well, I think it's, like, to me at least, I find it takes more skill to find the depth in comedy and yeah. like the different elements that make it rather than because there's also like senses of seriousness in comedy
yeah, yeah
like
yeah.
It just takes more skill I think to kind of understand it
yeah
which is probably why he did it later in life but I found these all to be a little bit spooky or gross or scary kind yeah. of like in that realm
yeah
I appreciated the color contrasts
yeah
you know they were all in black and white except for little like pokes of color here and there
mm-hmm.
It reminded me a lot because I'm watching I'll Be Gone in the Dark on HBO, the
yeah
docuseries on the Golden State Killer and Michelle McNamara. And there's all these allusions she makes when they're kind of like talking about early on his when he was doing his raping and killing about
oh, yeah.
like similarities between that. And she always references the creature from the Black Lagoon. And there's, like, a scene where the woman's swimming in the lake and the creature is, like, underneath and swimming underneath her and, like, goes to reach for her.
Uh-huh.
Considering how old that movie is, it always, like, a lot of these, like, scenes really brought me to that movie.
Oh,
specifically that scene. And how, I don't know, it just, that one kind of feels, I've never seen the movie in total, but it seems a little bit surrealist. And my brain just did, like, a quick little, like, comparison with that and the woman in the tank.
Oh, to, yeah, yeah.
What's that? It's a Guillermo del Toro movie.
The Fish Man. Shape of Water.
Yes. I almost called it Lady in Water. I was like, that's not that movie. It's a different movie. But I was like, Shape of Water.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Yeah. I agree. I think it's interesting to see just even, you know, technically, like how he started off
mm-hmm.
with such a darker kind of way more contrasty type of black and white. And then you look at like what did Jack do? And it's a very yeah. medium black and white, very, you know,
soft,
easy gray tones. Yeah. Like I've been saying the whole time, I like seeing where, you know, his earliest ideas were and how uh-huh. he's still kind of exploring the same techniques, even if it's not the same ideas necessarily. But yeah, I definitely enjoy watching them. I don't think I will be revisiting them too much. Mm-mm. Although, the newer shorts he's done, I feel like I can go back and watch those several times.
Yeah.
He just released a couple that we might be able to do shorts, like, for the whole summer. I don't know. We'll talk about it on the check-in, but...
Yeah. I think something that I was thinking about with these shorts compared to the newer ones is that I think about a lot when you're like a young, especially a young artist, and you're, I feel like the main goal is obviously to create your art, but it's to provoke reactions.
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of like what these earlier pieces, it seems like their goal is to provoke some sort of feeling,
yeah,
a reaction in you. And not that the later ones don't, but I feel like the later ones, they develop more of like a gradual reaction, yes, rather, yes, than an immediate.
It's not like I want to poke you. It's more like let me get under your skin and make you think about this for a while.
Yeah, it's more of a gradual response.
Yeah, I definitely agree. Mm-hmm. All right, well, that was fun. I can't wait to do some more of the newer stuff too. But let's move on to recommendations.
Yeah. I have two recommendations today.
Okay.
One is a video game. It's called God of War.
Ah.
I think
talking about that one.
Yeah, I've been talking about this because every time I like buy a new game and I start playing it and I get obsessed with the story, and I need to talk to someone about this. But it came out, I think, 2 years ago, and it's the fourth game in a series of other ones also called God of War, and it's about this Greek god called Kratos, who's the son of Zeus. And he's, I think, a god of war. And in the earlier versions, it's like he's this immoral god. I think he sells his soul for something.
Oh.
Or I think maybe his weapons or power or something. And so he's like unfeeling, and he is, you know, kind of rebelling against the gods. And there's like all these fights, and he, you know, kills certain gods, and it disrupts the hierarchy. But this one, it's I really enjoyed this one because the narrative was so different than the other ones. Everything looked so pretty. It takes place in Nordic mythology.
Oh, interesting.
So I think, and there's lots of talk of transcending realms and traveling. So I think you
I can't say it. What's that tree? Yggdrasil? That like great world tree.
Yeah, it's referenced in this game a lot, the world tree. But the main focus is with this Greek mythology, and I enjoyed it so much, just learning about different, like, true Greek mythology. Because, like, you know, I knew about Thor, you know, from Marvel, and that's Loki.
Like, Viking?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you really get to, like, know, like, a lot of these gods. Like, this god named Baldur, who's the brother of Thor.
Hammer?
No. His thing is that his mother was Freya, who was raised by witches. And she gave him, I don't know if it was a spell or some sort of charm, where he could not feel anything and he could not be killed.
Oh.
Because she didn't want to lose him.
I always love learning about, like, mythology through things like video games and books. Like, I like to read those Percy Jackson books just so I can, like, learn about all the different gods and goddesses.
Yeah. And this one, it does a really good job where, like, you're Kratos and you're with your son. And your son is like, he doesn't know that he's half god, but he has like, his like thing was he can just understand languages, like most of them.
Cool.
And so he like has a journal that he writes all his notes in about like different creatures you meet and different gods and like their relationships. And it's just really interesting to read about it and find out all these new people I had no idea about. And
that's cool.
Yeah. And it sounds like they set up for a sequel because you don't ever meet Thor, you never meet Odin. You never meet any of, like, the big name gods besides Freya.
Uh-huh. Well, you could just watch Marvel movies for those.
Yeah. But the ending has, like, a nice little twist at the end that I did not see coming.
Cool. And I'm
really excited for the sequels or downloadable content to come out.
Awesome.
I want to learn more. And then my second one, this is probably going to be my most strange recommendation because I've not actually watched all of it. But the show Legion on FX.
Oh, I've seen that. I love it.
I've only seen the first two seasons. It's only 3 seasons long. Josh is watching the 3rd season now. And I kind of
finally.
Yeah. I kind of just peeked in on the most recent episode he watched, and it looked so cool, so scary. It was like the
It's definitely kind of surrealist too.
Oh yeah, very much like modern surrealism.
Yeah,
it's just so cool and so interesting. And this third season seems like they really like went all out on like the storyline, and went, I never know what to expect from the show, so I would definitely watch it. It's not your typical Marvel X-Men kind of thing.
Oh no, not at all. It's pretty interesting. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm going to have for my recommendation also a video game. Mm-hmm. I think the scene from Premonitions from an Evil Deed kind of inspired me, because I was thinking about all of my favorite, because I really, I don't know, I love playing dystopian future video games. Mm-hmm. But I'm really into adventure games, and one of my favorite companies that has made them is called Wadjet Eye. Like, I don't know, Wadjet.
Mm-hmm.
But their game Techno Babylon is really interesting. It like takes place in this future world where people can upload to like a computer network type thing, and a lot of people like spend all their time there. And then you're kind of also a police officer who's trying to solve a murder, who's like being squeezed by bad guys. Mm-hmm. And so you're like this hacker girl and this detective, and you kind of meet up, and it's a really cool game. I love all of their games, so. But Techno Babylon, I would suggest. You can play it on iOS. I don't know if you can play it on Switch. It's definitely on like Steam.
Mm-hmm.
Which I want to get a PlayStation just so I can play Steam. Is that weird?
No. I don't know.
I've wanted to play Steam forever, but I hate sitting at my computer.
Yeah, I had a Switch like you for a while, and I enjoy the Switch a lot, but like having these like major platform like consoles like Xbox or PS4, like,
yeah,
I remember going to the marketplace for the first time and being like, how do I choose one game? There's so many.
I know the first one I'll get when I get Steam. But if you ever get a new PS whatever, like a fancier one, I'll buy your old one so I can.
I'll just give it to you.
All right. Well, okay. So next week is a check-in.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll talk about what's coming next. I'm very excited. We were doing the summer of new, but I think we're switching over to the summer of silly fun, because yes, I can't take anything heavy right now. It's just been way too much. So yeah, we'll tell you all about it in the next episode.
Mm-hmm.
And if you want to get in contact with us.
Yes, you could email us at mannersandmadness@gmail.com. Our Twitter is @mannersmadness, Instagram @mannersmadnesspod. And our website is mannersandmadness.com, and you can leave us a voice message.
Yes, and please rate and review, at least on Apple Podcasts, because I think that's the only place you can do it. And
yes, 5 stars, please.
You know, yeah, follow us on Twitter, Instagram, all that good stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, we'll be back with you next week. And we hope y'all are doing well.
Yeah, see you then.
Good night. This podcast is gonna go off the rails.
It'll fit the shorts.
Yeah. It's put me in a weird mindset. What was I saying?